Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we talk with Robert Waxler and David Beckman. They forged a friendship in college, reconnecting decades later over a shared love of philosophy and literature. They recently published a book together titled You Say, I Say, Staying Alive with Literature, Language, and Friendship. We talk with them about friendship and connection. But first, Kate Hooley is the author of The Maestro and Her Protege. Nice to see you again, Kate.
Great to be here, Mindy.
All right, so this is a story. It's really a window, right, into a musical world that many of us don't get to experience. You are a musician. Where did this idea come from?
Oh, boy. You know, I keep tracing that back further and further. What happened was I was working on this novel before I wrote Cottage for Sale, and I was sitting at my desk. I remember the precise moment. I remember where my desk was in the room. And this character went off to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger. And I'm the kind of writer when I write fiction that I follow the characters. And so I remember sitting there going, okay, I've never been to Paris, so this will be tricky. But I do know something about Nadia Boulanger because she was my teacher's teacher. I had a theory teacher in music school who studied with Boulanger. And whenever he mentioned her name, which he did, he would refer to her in class, there was this something in his voice that almost felt like fear. And that's how I felt about my theory teacher. But he was like such a demanding guy. I couldn't imagine there could be someone who intimidated him. So, you know, the little seed had been planted, my curiosity about Nadia Boulanger. So when this character decided to go study with her, I realized I had, first of all, a whole lot of research ahead of me. But I wasn't that worried on one hand because I felt like I had some sense of Boulanger already.
Yeah. So the story follows Hannah Schaefer, who's fictional, right? And some of the people she comes across, including her mentor, as you're talking, Nadia Boulanger, are real life people. So let's start with Hannah. Tell us a little bit about Hannah.
Yeah. So the book is historical fiction, which means I'm blending true life history and chronology with fiction. So Hannah is 100% made up, and she is, the word is never used, but she's essentially a prodigy. And she gets sent to study with Nadia Boulanger, who was a master musician and teacher. If you can name a 20th century American composer, there's a really good chance that that person studied with Boulanger. She was quite the force in the musical life of the late 20th century. So Hannah goes off to study with Boulanger. Hannah's just 10 years old. And the story of Hannah's coming of age musically and as a woman sort of spins out from there. And there's two lines, you know, there's sort of two narrative lines in the novel. So we meet Hannah at age 10, but we also meet Hannah at age 58.
Yeah.
And those two are braided together.
Yeah. So yeah, you're alternating the chapters between those formative years as a prodigy in 1960s Paris, right? And then her present day quest at succeeding in a male dominated industry.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about Nadia Boulanger is she actually conducted the Boston Symphony in 1938 and the New York Philharmonic. In the case of the Boston Symphony, there wasn't another woman conductor at the podium until 2007. And so it is a profession that has been traditionally very much dominated by men. So I wanted to play with that. Like, what is it like to be a woman trying to make your way, and an incredibly talented and very, as it unfolds, clearly ambitious woman, trying to make her way, trying to find her place in that world. Mm-hmm. And so that's a piece of, you know, what I think is central to the story, is this idea of a woman in a man's world.
Right. She is encouraged by Nadia Boulanger to focus on her music. And
Absolutely.
That means lots of different kinds of sacrifices, right? And one is she has a bit of a crush on a fellow musician who's a bit older. She's mm-hmm. known him since she was 10. And I wonder if you'd read a little bit about that in the book for us.
Sure. Yeah. So at this point, Hannah is, I think, 18. She's 18. And so this means she's been studying with Boulanger for 8 years, which is important to note. I had noticed Peter during my first summer at Fontainebleau. His white blonde hair and intense blue eyes, his gentle manner with me, and the fierceness in him that came out when he played. I probably did have a little girl crush on him even then. Once, a girlfriend of Peter's had come to a public concert, and I inspected her as if I were his mother. I wanted her to be perfect for him, exactly right, beautiful and smart, talented, just like Peter. I was 13, and like a true student of Mademoiselle, I believed I could become Renee if only I just studied her closely and long enough. She is a waste of his time and focus, Mademoiselle declared. If they marry, I will have to send a sympathy note. The thing was, she meant it. On the occasion of the marriage of a particularly promising student, Madame Boulanger was rumored to have sent a note of condolence on black-edged stationery. She could be happy enough for the students for whom she did not envision a life as lifelong musicians, but for those of us with promise, she wanted vows of celibacy. Music must come first and last, and it left no room in the middle.
And so Madame Boulanger is the mentor, as you're mentioning, and she did exist in real life. You had this connection with somebody who studied under her. I'm sure you had to do more research. Did you talk to other? How did you, you know, and how much of her personality in the book do you think is true to who she was in real life?
Well, I like to feel that Nadia and I have a special connection, and I've depicted her in a way that would probably annoy her just a little bit. So yes, I read, there are a few stories from students, there's a few books that written by students. I read so much for this book. I read about Leonard Bernstein. I read about Nadia Boulanger. There was a really interesting book called Conversations, the title was Mademoiselle. Her students all called her Mademoiselle, which isn't a term used in contemporary France, but that was how she was known. She wasn't Mademoiselle Boulanger, she wasn't Nadia, she was Mademoiselle. Everyone called her. So there's a book called Mademoiselle, and the subtitle is Conversations with Nadia Boulanger. I actually read that book after I started writing. I didn't want to be too influenced, but I did want to understand her voice and understand her language, her use of language, which I talk about a little in the book, that, you know, Hannah thinks maybe that that Nadia thinks in French and then translates to English. So her language is a little bit stilted. But yes, I read a lot about her. She was known, there was one book by a student called The Tender Tyrant. She was known to be tyrannical. You get a sense of that from the Black Edge Stationery there. She was very active in the musical world, friends with all sorts of people, Ravel, Stravinsky. And she had a very active correspondence life. So she was very connected in the world, but she was also very convinced that her students needed to focus on music. There's a quote at the beginning of the book that says something like, you know, only study music unless you feel you will die if you do not.
You know? I love that description of tender tyrant, because that really fits her, doesn't it? Yeah. All right, and you write about Paris in such a loving way. And I thought, oh, you must have spent some time there.
I did, yes. As I mentioned, when I first started the book, I had never been. I was lucky enough to have a project at the time. A lot of the time that I was working on this book, I was working, designing and working with booksellers, and I had a project take me to Paris. And so I was able to stay for a few extra days. And that was the first moment that I had a new understanding about the book, because I went to the cemetery where Nadia Boulanger is buried, and I found myself sitting at her grave, just bawling my eyes out for this woman that I never knew, you know? And I started to realize that I was sort of inhabiting this character of Hannah. I started to understand a little bit more about Hannah's life and her relationship with Nadia Boulanger and how it extended. You know, I like to think that part of what this book is about is how love and connection transcend the inconvenience of death. And I understood in that moment that, you know, something about the book was really changing. I literally went home and threw out all my pages and started again. And I was lucky in the next several years to have my work at the time required me to fly a lot. I had a lot of frequent flyer points. I made friends with a couple who had an apartment in Paris, and they would just vacate their apartment and go. They had a home also in the Loire Valley, and they would go there, and I would go to Paris, and I would have them over for dinner, and it was lovely. It was like this whole side little story that was going on. So I was able to go for like 3 weeks at a time. I lived in Boulanger's neighborhood. I hung out at the cemetery. I went to her apartment, you know, the kinds of things that really help with the atmosphere. And yes, of course, I think it's hard not to. I fell in love with Paris.
Yeah. So I'm wondering about you're a cat person, and
I
cats play a role in this book. The feral
They
cats in
do.
the cemetery. Is that total fiction? Or did you
No, that
actually,
is
you saw that?
completely
Okay.
true.
That's
That
funny.
is. Yes, because I started going to the cemetery, and I did all of this. The part of the book that is true is Hannah going to the cemetery, rehabilitating. There's a beautiful garden in the Boulanger plot. It's a family, you know, it's a family tomb. It's you know, Paris cemeteries look a lot different than our cemeteries, as many European do. And there's a garden just built into the tomb, and it was all overgrown, and I kind of reclaimed it. And every time I'd go, I'd, you know, move things around. So that part that's in the book that Hannah does, that's why I started to get confused. Was I Hannah? Was I Kate? I'm not sure, you know. And the cats are there, and there are a number of people, really interesting people, who come to the cemetery every day and feed the cats. And I started to get to know some of the cat feeders, and I became one almost instantly. And I got to know some of, you know, I got to know some of the cats. And that was a surprise. And I always felt like when I came home, my own cat would kind of give me a dirty look, like, you know, they've been
Didn't know,
cheating on
yeah.
him.
I don't know if I ever really gave much thought about what type of talent a conductor needs to be good at it. This story is really insightful in that way. It really does make you appreciate the talent that Hannah had, even though she's a fictional character, what she her talent is real in real life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that folks like Hannah, who are really operating at the absolute top of the game, and in the highest levels of music, really have a tremendous powers, as Boulanger did herself, of absorption. You know, just being able to literally absorb the music and understand it. Incredible amount of training, but also a certain level of intuitiveness around music and around how to understand. Again, when you're conducting an orchestra, you have to understand, you have to have an understanding of all the parts, not just the instruments, but all the parts that are in front of you on a score and how they fit together, you know. And the other thing that I played with Hannah is how many parts, you know, how many pieces does she have memorized? Because a lot of conductors, you'll go to you know, even at any level, you can go to a concert and notice the conductor is conducting without a score because they have memorized it, you
Yeah, it's
know.
amazing. All right, Leonard Bernstein, another real person, takes Hannah under his wing. Tell us about that relationship and what research you had to do. Is that his? It seems like that would be his personality. Is that true to who he was?
Yeah, I think it is. Again, I did my best for all these guys. There was a book I read. By Schuyler Chapin, who's also in the novel, very briefly, very brief cameo, but he worked and was a business partner with Lenny, and I feel like I can call him Lenny. And he wrote a memoir about his friendship, and that was probably the one book that helped me the most. But I also scoured, I read Leonard Bernstein's own writing, and I also have an auction catalog from when their apartment went up for sale. So I tried to, you know, get that ambience right. I picked him because I thought if Hannah, as a woman in now we're in the 70s, a young woman with promise, I knew that Boulanger had connections to Bernstein, and so I felt that would be a natural connection, as well as an introduction that could happen. But I also thought that he would be open to a woman in a way that others might not. And at this point, it's a men's club.
Mm-hmm.
There,
yeah.
You know, and when Hannah gets her first podium, which is a lot earlier than in real life a woman got a major podium, it's a huge deal.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the relationship with Marie. I don't want to give too much away in the book, but this is where, you know, Hannah's been the student, right? And now she becomes the teacher.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's, you know, the title has a lot of layers to it. Hannah is a protege. Hannah is a maestro. Boulanger is a maestro, and Hannah is a protege, but then Marie comes into the story and Hannah is established at this point as a maestro, but she maybe is a maestro without a protege, right?
Yeah.
So Marie leads me to Luke. I'm going to just say a little bit about Luke, who mm-hmm. is another key character in the book, and he works for the police. He's an inspector. His job is a little closer to what an attorney general might be in the United States. And so he's out there in the community, and he is also had been a music major in college. And so he's kept up his instrument, which is the trumpet, and he has organized an orchestra that, you know, we sort of call it the orchestra for the wayward kids. It's for kids that are in trouble or in halfway houses in Paris. This is completely made up, by the way. and so he's in charge of this little orchestra, and Marie plays in that, and he comes to know Marie. So Marie has a troubled past. Mostly none of it is her fault. She's had a really difficult childhood. And through Luke, who becomes connected to Hannah, Hannah meets Marie. And although she has some resistance because she doesn't think of herself as a teacher, she agrees to hear Marie, who plays the flute, and eventually to teach her. And over time, the lessons, as her lessons with Nadia did, become more than just about the music.
Power of music, right? The power
right.
of music. That's a. I'm wondering, a lot of times in novels, there are characters that you maybe weren't thinking were going to have much of a role, and they just won't be quiet. Is there anybody in this story that was for you, that you went, okay, they ended up with a bigger role than I anticipated?
So as opposed to characters being small that got big, I was really a little worried about Lanny Bernstein and how he might become too big and take over the book. And so I realized as soon as we had the connection between Boulanger and Bernstein and she introduced him to Hannah, that I needed to keep my eye on him. So I kind of made him a little constrained, but it's pretty hard to constrain him. I felt like he was a really important character, and he was really an important foil to Boulanger, where Boulanger demands a strict musical life. Bernstein was all about loving life and living a bigger life. So he works in that way, but I didn't want him to take over.
Yeah. What do you hope readers take away from the book?
Well, first, I hope that they love the world. I feel like I loved the world. Every time I returned to this book through the years, I would say, oh my God, I love the characters in this book. I just want to hang with them. So I hope that they enjoy the world. I don't feel like I wasn't writing it to teach, but it probably does teach a little bit along the way. But I want them to think about the teachers in their lives and how they have impact that transcends time. I think that's probably something that's important about the book. And I think it's also about, like Cottage for Sale is really, it's about community, finding unexpected community and connection. And I think Hannah does that in her present day Paris life.
The book is The Maestro and Her Protege. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Kate Hooley, always great to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up after a break, Robert Waxler and David Beckman talk about their book, You Say, I Say, Staying Alive with Literature, Language, and Friendship. You're listening to The Point. Robert Wachsler and David Beckman forged a friendship in college, reconnecting decades later over a shared love of philosophy and literature. They recently published a book together titled You Say, I Say, Staying Alive with Literature, Language, and Friendship. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
So you were both college freshman at Brown University in 1962, where you met. Tell us a little bit more about that friendship you had in your younger years. David, why don't you start?
Okay, happily. My first memory of Bob was in the pool room at Font's house at Brown, which is a sort of the student union. But we also roomed next to each other as freshmen, and we became part of a group. And we quickly realized that the group we wanted to be part of was going to be English majors, writers, comparative literature majors. We threw in a philosopher or two. But students our age, 18, 19, who kind of had their eye on language and what it could lead to and what poetry was about. And so we kind of had a group, met informally, and we'd have late night bull sessions around these topics. But we had a lot of extracurricular fun as well.
Yeah.
So it was, I think, a fairly typical finding your tribe as an undergraduate.
Oh, I like finding your tribe. What do you remember about it, Bob?
I do remember that. I remember the pool room, playing a lot of pool at the time. And as David said, we were freshmen when it started out at Mead House, which was basically a freshman dorm. So we got to know each other. And then a couple of years later, still at Brown, obviously, maybe we were juniors, I think, at the time, we moved off campus, and there was a house that we rented with a couple of other people, but David and I were, it was still very friendly. And it was on Hope Street, interesting enough, so that we thought there was some metaphorical value just in the idea that we were living on Hope Street now. And we continued to talk a lot about literature, as David said, in these classic bull sessions that we would have late at night, which for us, at least, I think was more inspiring than anything we would find in the seminars, even around the table at Brown.
Yeah.
And we decided, because we both wanted to be writers, we kept thinking about that, we decided we'd try to put out a poetry pamphlet that we called Echo Aeonides. And so we had some poems in it by David, some poems that I had written. And there was a third person that we used to hung around with. He wasn't at Brown at the time, George Wetmore, but he also contributed. So, and we got that pamphlet published, and it had some success, certainly in our terms anyway. It was written up in the Brown Daily Herald, and people were talking about it on the campus. So we really thought that we were well on our way to being very successful writers, and we felt good about that. And the friendship kept growing in terms of the sharing of the writing, the sharing of literature. But then we graduated, and although each of us in our own unique, precious individual lives pursued our particular paths, and we didn't have a lot of contact. I think, at least unconsciously, that friendship, that sense of discussions about literature and language, and that initial writing together of poetry, all stayed with us. Mm-hmm. And it was several years later, I had put a letter into an alumni magazine at Brown, and David saw it, and that sort of kicked off another wonderful
2014, Bob. 2014. That's where you guys kind of come back together, right? So, and I always, you know, that's the beauty of like true friendships, right? Is that, you know, you just pick up where you left off. And that's what you guys did, right? When you reconnected in 2014.
True.
Yeah. All right. So David, at that time, you began an exchange of emails, right? Which, of course, was what the book is about. But describe those emails when you first started reconnecting in 2014.
Yeah. My wife and I visited Bob and his wife outside of New Bedford. And I got talking with Bob, and we'd hooked up previous to that in New York. We'd spent some time. So we were friends again. And Bob pulled out a stack of papers and notebooks that he was doing research on all kinds of writers that we didn't necessarily study at Brown. He said, I've got all this material. What am I going to do with it? I didn't, you know, have a solution, but I said, well, or somehow it evolved. Let's do something together. I'll go back to California. Bob will still be on the East Coast, but let's start emailing each other. And Bob can start sharing some of this research he'd done, and I could share other writers I discovered and what the writing life had been for me in New York and also in California. So that really, excuse me, kicked it off. 3 years of what turned out to be pretty rich emails on all kinds of subjects,
right.
Literary, non-literary, friendship. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Bob, when did you go, hey, we got a book here?
Well, yeah, it took a little while. I mean, I was thinking of trying to write some kind of book anyway, just to keep busy, if nothing else. And then when David and I met first in New York, and then when he came down to New Bedford and saw me there and we talked, that's when we began to think about not the book, but just of exchanging ideas and things like that. And I would say it was probably around, you know, 3 years ago that we, you know, maybe even 2.5 years ago that as we continue to exchange these ideas, you know, it seemed to me at least that this was. At least possibly the book that I had been thinking about, but it would be really wonderful to do it together with David. Mm-hmm. I have found that I've published a number of books, and I have found, you know, some I've written by myself, others with other people. And I think there is something really interesting for me, at least, and unique about writing with another person. And in this case, it worked out, I think, extraordinarily well, because I think that that each person has his own, again, unique, precious life. And that's part of the responsibility we have as human beings to discover what our story is. And we can do that in a number of different ways, but part of it for me is through writing and thinking about literature and these other things. But at the same time, it's not just a individual unique life, because we're always connected with other people. We're always in an environment where there's language that surrounds us. So to think with others, even if the other person doesn't agree with you, mm-hmm. I think makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And it's beneficial. So I think these discussions, again, over those 2-3 years, as we began to really think seriously about the book itself and writing a book rather than just exchanging ideas.
It's like you brought those late night bull sessions right into book form. You take this deep dive, so to speak, into literature, and, you know, shared observations and opinions, sometimes agreeing and sometimes not.
Yeah, true.
I think the part of the notion there is that you know, we have a responsibility to think of in terms of our own unique lives, but at the same time, we also have a large responsibility to listen closely to the views of others and to feel responsible for bringing all that thought together as well as we can over the course of our own lives. Mm. And in that sense, to me at least, it's, as you suggested, Mindy, the notion of having another person in a dialogue is, to me, really an important part of mortal human life. We can't know everything, although we might strive to know everything. But we can, the one thing we can do is to enter into dialogue with others. We need at least two or three people. We need Mindy and David and Bob. And that makes a difference because it widens the scope, and we need to be, responsible enough to say, even if we disagree, that yeah, this is an interesting perspective you have, David.
And as
I don't
reader,
listen. I don't. I
as readers, you can look at it, you go, okay, I this time I agree with David, or this time I agree with Bob, right?
Yeah,
But
no, absolutely. That's right.
since you mentioned that you can't know everything, early in the book, David, you wrote, "I am 80 years old now, though, and I'm beginning to think that Socrates had it right. The beginning of wisdom comes when you realize you know nothing."
That's taking it to a radical place.
Yeah.
I hear that somewhat frequently from older people. "I know so much less now than I did when I was young."
Yeah.
To know nothing, that's going a total Zen direction, I think. But yeah, I'm finding the ability to learn now and respond comes out of a lack of hubris, an acknowledgement that things that I relied on so much, checkpoints along the way, intellectually or otherwise, I've got to question those. Maybe that was just a life raft to hold on to, and I don't need it anymore.
Yeah,
So,
good
but yeah,
point.
it's an interesting.
I'm wondering if you can both talk a little bit about what you learned from this experience. Who wants to go first?
Oh boy.
Well, for me, one of the things that I would underline in terms of the writing of the book and then hopefully the reading of it for people who pick it up and look through it is that, as David was just suggesting too, the book itself, I think, increasingly emphasizes the notion of the importance of questions. The raising of questions. It's like, we're on a journey in terms of our own lives and in this mortal world. And again, when we may not know much, maybe, as Socrates said, we know nothing. But the ability to ask questions and to be open to all kinds of possibilities, I think, is part of the energy of the book. It's that which pursuing here, and the hope, I think, in terms of the publication of it, maybe this is part of the reason why I thought it would be nice to put it into a book form, was to sort of give this possibility to others, to readers, that if they ask the questions, they're pursuing the journey of their own lives in many ways, but they have to stay open to that ability to ask the questions. I don't think we can know all the answers. We don't want to give up on pursuing the answers. And sometimes, if we do get an answer, it's not the answer we really wanted, which is also somewhat risky at times. But I think the questions, the quest itself, the journey allows us to know more about ourselves, as Socrates also said, know thyself, and know our relations with as well as we can, with the rest of the mortal world, as long as we stay alive.
Yeah. David, what about you? What did you learn from the experience?
Oh my, a couple of categories there come to mind. One is that I got to know my good friend Bob even better than I had. What a rich mind he has. His career as a professor of romantic poetry at University of Massachusetts, I had not known much about, and the paths that led him into deep into William Blake, and I learned so much more about Blake that I hadn't known. I thought I knew some, and I did a little, but Bob's a professional when it comes to Blake. It was such a joy to enter his mind and follow the path that he had taken and what teaching meant to him. I went to New York and became a commercial writer and then wrote poetry and plays on the side and tried to keep that balance going. Other things I learned were just incredible. For example, I had never thought much about the difference between the Old Testament, its view of writing, its view of more than that, human destiny, and the classic Greeks and Romans. And, they're a little bit co-equal in impact, very co-equal in impact, but time, place, not quite so much. Mediterranean venues. But the mindset that was so different, and I was more probably more focused on the classics than the Old Testament, and Bob brought that whole awareness. So we had a lot of fun about the difference of the world view from these two incredibly different and yet close civilizations. That was completely new to me.
We're talking with Robert Waxler and David Beckman about their book, You Say, I Say, Staying Alive with Literature, Language, and Friendship. We'll have more after a quick break.
But we had a complement of MPs that took over Crest Hall. And of course, some of our young girls met them and some married, and some of those men were here, stayed here.
Irene Smith of Nantucket.
And that also goes for the time when they had built that funny little old naval base out in Sconset. There were a big bunch of young men that came here, which is a blessing for our young girls. We still have some of them here, too. And then, of course, in the 60s, we had the flower children and the hippies, and they came. They felt that our resentment about some of their activities is, well, you might as well get used to us because we are going to stay. When some of them did, and there's some of our best people on the island.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Robert Waxler and David Beckman about their book, You Say, I Say, Staying Alive with Literature, Language, and Friendship. Certainly we get a lot of your thoughts on literature, but you could also, if you're going to put this in a section of books in the bookstore, it could also be in philosophy, right?
I think so. Do you, Bob? Did we get over that bar? I think so.
I think so.
Oh, I think so. No, philosophy, philosophic aesthetics, the whole question really of theoretical issues related to art and music really as well, and certainly poetry and novel writing. I think all those things taken as a kind of literary and philosophic reflections is an important part of the book. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But where you put it, I mean, you raise another interesting issue there, Mindy, too, because when we're thinking about, publishing it and, where we'd find the best publisher for what we had here, we also understood that in a sense there was something out of the ordinary in terms of how you categorize the book itself. And of course, in terms of marketing, that becomes sometimes problematic because hesitant to publish a book, which is really a mix of a whole bunch of things. I mean, to some extent, it's some personal biography or memoir, talking about friendship, and on the other side is there are moments where it's abstract in that sense that it has in certain parts of the book certainly what might be thought of as more academic thinking, although I think it's fair to say that the prose itself, the writing is clear. It's You know, it doesn't get so academic and abstract that it's using simply, the jargon of that particular group. So I think it does transcend that.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you might both share your thoughts on the power of the written word. And Bob, folks may remember that, you know, you're the co-founder of Changing Lives Through Literature, which was with, you know, people who are sentenced to jail time, criminal offenders. And really, we've talked about this on the show before, it absolutely transformed many lives through this program. So I want you to talk a little bit about your thoughts on the power of the written word.
Well, I'll go for
I think,
go ahead, Bob.
Okay. Yeah, I think the program Changing Lives Through Literature, as you suggest, really is a great testimony to what literature can do and how literature can, in a very positive and productive way, affect people's lives. The program, by the way, even though I've retired now in terms of my own academic credentials. The program continues. And as you asked, Mindy, what is literature? How does it work in this environment, or at least in this, through this kind of program? To me, at least, the answer over and over again has come back since the early 1990s when we started the program. It has an answer that includes a feeling of people around a table having read the same book. Each person, even though they've read the same story, has read it differently. So it's as if they've read the same book, but at the same time they've read a different book. They have a relationship with that book, and at the same time they have a relationship with the people around the table. As we discuss the story or the novel as a book, it becomes increasingly clear that literature somehow connects with each of the people around that table, but it's as if the book has talked to that person as much as the person has entered into a dialogue with the book. And then to enter into a further discussion around the table that night, you began to see how this little story expands into the consciousness of each individual, and at the same time how it brings us together through what I have to believe is a kind of empathy that we all have potentially as human beings to help at least understand each other. I remember just a quick example, which I think is a great testimony to what reading and literature can do, is I remember one night we had read this book, which many people I know must be familiar with, the Hemingway story, Old Man and the Sea. And we got together the following week after some discussion of that book. We were about ready to start a discussion of a new book. And one person around the table said, Professor Waxler, before we get started, I want to tell you one thing. I want to tell everybody one thing, really, about my experience over the course of the week or so with Old Man and the Sea. And he said, I was walking down the street thinking a little about the old man and what we had talked about in class. And I came to a corner downtown New Bedford, and I was going to turn to the right, which was where my old neighborhood was. And we all knew, there were maybe 10 or 12 people that night around the table, we all knew what he was actually saying. I mean, he was struggling with drugs. He had, over the course of his own life, had continuous struggles with it. And he wanted that day to go back to his old neighborhood and he sort of heard the call of some drug dealers, and that was the clear implication. But then he said something which to me was almost unbelievable. He said, you know, I heard that voice from the neighborhood, the old neighborhood, but I also heard the voice of the old man. Santiago is his name. And he said, you know, the old man had a lot of struggles. He had a lot of turmoil in his own life, but he stayed with it. He didn't turn away. He didn't give in. He was a kind of heroic figure despite all his problems. And I remember the guy telling the story. I looked around the table then and he said, you know, when I heard that voice, it was as if Santiago was a friend of mine now that had become part of my heart. Mm. He was always going to be there. He was a friend forever. And his voice was a voice that really made me hesitate. And I finally stopped and didn't turn back to the neighborhood that day. I walked straight down the main street as I was walking and kept listening and, in a sense, talking and dialogue to Santiago. So, you know, when I heard that story, I was overwhelmed because I said, yeah, that's the power of great literature. Literature can do that. It's just, he's made a permanent friend. I mean, there's a fictional character, Santiago, and he may not exist, flesh and blood, but he exists.
Exists in his mind,
His power. You know, the reader, you know, I was moved, and certainly the reader and everyone around the table, I remember, sort of shook their head.
We could relate. Yeah. What about for you, David? What do you think? What are your thoughts on the power of the?
Yeah. Well, I'm a thorough believer in the power of the written word. Felt I was born that way. But a particular incident that comes to mind to me, which is when I was first in New York. I taught school for a couple of years in a private high school, and 16, 17 year olds, I guess I was teaching junior and senior level. And I wanted to teach Catcher in the Rye, which had been a, you know, huge impact book 10 years or so before when I was their age. And I remember the headmaster of the school said, well, I don't know, how about Dickens? Can't we do Dickens? I thought and said, I don't think that will have the impact with these kids that a book should have. Dickens is great and all that, but I want to challenge them. And I made my cases, fine, teach it. So that semester, we read Catcher in the Rye. And these kids, many of whom weren't born to be successful in school exactly, were so riveted from day one, from the first page. I had them and I was so happy because they were hanging on every word, and they thought Holden Caulfield was somebody who lived right next door to them. I mean, they couldn't get enough of it. And we had wonderful discussions about his nature and the language in the book and how current it was for them. Even though the book was written back, I guess, right after World War II. It was just a riveting experience, and it just said to me all over again, and it has said later on, you're not going to get this in the internet. You're not going to get this in social media. The printed word, if you give it the benefit of the doubt in our time, will deliver such power as to change people's lives or reaffirm to people what their lives are about. So that's,
The book is You Say, I Say, Staying Alive with Literature, Language, and Friendship. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Robert Waxler and David Beckman, thank you for sharing your thoughts and friendship with the rest of us. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Mindy. Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.